Disc 8.
Chapter 27. Zurich. Carlo Casagrande strode the chandeliered hallway on the fourth floor of the Hotel Saint Cotard and presented himself at the door of room 423. He glanced at his watch, 7:20 p.m., the precise time he had been instructed to come, then knocked twice. A confident knock, firm enough to make his presence known, not enough to disturb the occupants of the neighbouring rooms. From the other side of the door came a voice in Italian, instructing Casagrande to enter the room. He spoke Italian well, for a foreigner. The fact that it lacked even the hint of a German accent sent acid flooding into Casagrande's stomach. He pushed open the door and stepped inside, pausing on the threshold. A wedge of light from the chandelier in the corridor illuminated a portion of the room, and for an instant Casagrande could see the outline of a figure seated in a wing chair. When the door swung shut, the darkness was complete. Casagrande inched forward through the gloom until his shin collided with an unseen coffee table. He was made to stand there, enveloped in black, for several painful seconds. Finally, a powerful lamp burst on, like a searchlight in a guard tower, and shone directly into his face. He raised his hand and tried to shield his eyes from the glare. It felt like a needle in his cornea.
"Good evening, General,"
a seductive voice, like warm oil.
"Did you bring the dossier?"
Casagrande held up the briefcase. The silenced Stechkin moved into the light and prodded him onward. Casagrande removed the file and laid it on the coffee table like an offertory. The beam of light tilted downward while the hand holding the weapon lifted the cover of the dossier. The light. Suddenly Casagrande was standing on the pavement outside his apartment in Rome, viewing the mutilated bodies of Angelina and his daughter by the beam of a carabinieri flashlight. "Death was instantaneous, General Casagrande. You can at least take comfort in the knowledge that your loved ones did not suffer." The light tilted suddenly upward. Too late, Casagrande tried to shield his eyes, but the beam found his retina, and for the next several seconds he had the sensation he was being swallowed by a giant, undulating orange sphere.
"So much for the Middle Ages being over," the assassin said.
The dossier slid across the table toward Casagrande.
"He's too heavily protected. This is an assignment for a martyr, not a professional. Find someone else."
"I need you."
"How can I be sure I won't be set up to take the fall, like that idiot from Istanbul? The last thing I want to do is spend the rest of my life rotting away in some Italian jail, begging a pope for forgiveness."
"I give you my word that you will not be used as a pawn or a patsy in some larger game. You will perform this service for me, then with my help you will be permitted to escape."
"The word of a murderer.
How reassuring.
Why should I trust you?"
"Because I would do nothing to betray you."
"Really? Did you know Benjamin Stern was an agent of Israeli intelligence when you hired me to kill him?"
"My God," thought Casagrande, "how does he know?"
He weighed the advantages of lying, but thought better of it.
"No," he said, "I did not know that the professor was connected to them in any way." "You should have."
There was a sudden edge to his voice, the blade of a trench knife. "And did you know that an agent named Gabriel Allon is investigating his death, along with the activities of your little group?"
"I didn't know his name until this moment."
"Obviously you've done some investigating of your own."
"I make it my business to know when someone is hunting me. I also know that Allon was at the Pensione Abruzzi in Rome, meeting with Inspector Alessio Rossi, when you sent an army of carabinieri in there to kill him."
"You should have come to me with your problems, General. Allon would be dead now."
"How? How does this monster know about the Israeli and Rossi? How is such a thing possible? He's a bully," thought Casagrande. "Bullies like to be placated."
He decided to play the role of the appeaser. It was not a role that came naturally to him.
"You're right," he said, his tone conciliatory. "I should have come to you. Obviously it would have been better for both of us. May I sit down?"
The light lingered on his face for a few more seconds. Then it fell upon an armchair, a few inches from the spot where Casagrande was standing. He sat down and placed his hands on his knees. The light remained in his eyes.
"The question is, General, can I trust you enough to work for you again, especially on something like this? Perhaps I can earn your trust."
"With what?"
"Money, of course. It would take a great deal of money." "The figure I had in mind was substantial," Casagrande said, "a sum of money that most men would consider sufficient to live on for a very long time."
"I'm listening."
$4 million.
$5 million, countered the assassin. "Half now, half on completion." Casagrande squeezed his kneecaps, trying to conceal his rising tension. It was not like quarreling with Cardinal Brindisi. The leopard's sanctions tended to be irrevocable.
$5 million, Casagrande said in agreement, "but you will be paid only $1 million of that in advance. If you choose to steal my money without fulfilling the terms of the contract, that's your business. If you want the remaining $4 million, Casagrande paused, "I'm afraid trust cuts both ways."
There was a long, uncomfortable silence, long enough for Casagrande to inch forward out of his chair and prepare to take his leave. He froze when the assassin said, "Tell me how it would be done." Casagrande spoke for the next hour, a veteran policeman calmly recounting the timeline of a rather mundane series of street crimes. All the while, the light bored into his face. It was making him hot. His suit jacket was soaked with sweat and was clinging to his back like a wet blanket. He wished he'd turn the damn thing off. He'd rather sit in the dark with the monster than stare into the light any longer.
"Did you bring the down payment?"
Casagrande reached down and patted the side of his attaché case.
"Let me see it."
Casagrande placed the attaché case on the table, opened it, and turned it so the assassin could see his money.
"Do you know what will happen to you if you betray me?"
"I'm certain I can imagine," Casagrande said, "but surely a down payment of that magnitude is enough to demonstrate my good faith."
"Faith? Is that what leads you to perform this act?"
"There are some things you're not permitted to know. Do you accept the contract?"
The assassin closed the attaché case and it disappeared into the darkness.
"There's just one last thing," Casagrande said. "You'll need security office identification to get past the Swiss guards and the carabinieri. Did you bring the photograph?"
Casagrande heard the rustle of fabric. Then a hand appeared, holding a passport photo. Poor quality. Casagrande reckoned it had been made by an automated machine. He looked at the image and wondered whether it was truly the face of the killing machine known as the Leopard. The assassin seemed to sense his thoughts, for a few seconds later the Stetchkin reappeared. It was pointed directly at Casagrande's heart.
"You wish to ask me a question?"
Casagrande shook his head.
"Good,"
the assassin said. "Get out." Chapter 28. Venice. The Acqua Alta lapped against the steps of the Church of San Zaccaria, as Francesco Tiepolo, dressed in an oilskin coat and rubber knee-length boots, made his way ponderously across the flooded square through the gathering dusk. He entered the church and sacrilegiously shouted out that it was time to close up for the night. Adriana Zanetti seemed to float down from her perch high atop the main altar. Antonio Politti yawned elaborately and struck a series of contortionist yoga poses, all designed to demonstrate to Tiepolo the harsh toll the day had taken on his young body. Tiepolo looked toward the Bellini. The shroud remained in place, but the fluorescent lamps were extinguished. With great effort, he resisted the impulse to scream. Antonio Politti appeared at Tiepolo's side and laid a paint-smudged paw on his heavy shoulder.
"When, Francesco? When are you going to get it through your head? He's not coming back."
When indeed? The boy wasn't ready for the Bellini masterpiece, but Tiepolo had no choice, not if the church was going to reopen to the public in time for the spring tourist season.
"Give him one more day," he said,
his gaze still fixed on the darkened painting.
"If he's not back by tomorrow afternoon, I'll let you finish it."
Antonio's joy was tempered by his unreserved interest in the tall, striking creature making her way apprehensively across the nave. She had black eyes and a head of abundant, uncontrollable dark hair. Tiepolo knew faces, bone structure. He'd bet his fee for the San Zaccaria project she was a Jewess. She seemed familiar to him. He thought he might have seen her once or twice in the church, watching the restorers working. Antonio started toward her. Tiepolo thrust out a thick arm, blocking his path, and summoned a watery smile.
"Is there something I can help you with, signorina?"
"I'm looking for Francesco Tiepolo."
Deflated, Antonio skulked away. Tiepolo laid a hand on his chest.
"You found him, my treasure."
"I'm a friend of Mario Del Vecchio."
Tiepolo's flirtatious gaze turned suddenly cold. He folded his arms across his massive chest and glared at her through narrowed eyes.
"Where in God's name is he?"
The woman said nothing, just reached out and handed him a slip of paper. He unfolded the note and read the words written there.
"Your friend in the Vatican is in grave danger. I need your help to save his life."
He looked up and stared at her in disbelief.
"Who are you?"
"It's not important, Signor Tiepolo."
He held up the note in his big paw.
"Where is he?"
"Will you help him save your friend's life?"
"I listen to what he has to say.
If my friend is truly in some sort of danger, of course I'll help." "Then you have to come with me."
"Now?"
"Please, Signor Tiepolo, I'm afraid we don't have much time."
"Where are we going?"
But she just seized him by the elbow and pulled him toward the door. Cannareggio smelled of salt and the lagoon. The woman led Tiepolo across a bridge spanning the Rio di Ghetto Nuovo, then into the clammy gloom of the Sotto Portego. A figure appeared at the opposite end of the passageway, a small man with his hands thrust into the pockets of a leather jacket, surrounded by a halo of yellow sodium light. Tiepolo stopped walking.
"Would you mind telling me what the fuck is going on?"
"Obviously you got my note."
"Interesting, but you must admit it was short on details, as well as one critical piece of information. How would you, an art restorer named Mario Del Vecchio, know that the Pope's life is in danger?"
"Because restoration is something of a hobby for me. I have another job, a job that very few people know about. Do you understand what I'm trying to say to you, Francesco?"
"Who do you work for?"
"Who I work for is not important."
"It's damned important if you want me to help you get to the Pope."
"I work for an intelligence service. Not always, just under special circumstances."
"Like a death in the family?"
"Actually, yes."
"Which intelligence service do you work for?"
"I would prefer not to answer that question."
"I'm sure you would, but if you want me to talk to the Pope, you're going to answer my questions. I repeat, what service do you work for? SISTE? Vatican Intelligence?"
"I'm not Italian, Francesco."
"Not Italian? That's very funny, Mario."
"My name isn't Mario."
They walked the perimeter of the square, Gabriel and Tiepolo side by side, Chiara a few paces behind. It took a long time for Tiepolo to process the information he had just been given. He was a shrewd man, a sophisticated Venetian, politically and socially connected, yet the situation confronting him now was well beyond anything he had ever experienced. It was as if he had just been told that the Titian altarpiece in the Frari was a reproduction painted by a Russian. Finally, he drew a deep breath, a tenor preparing himself for the climactic passage of an aria, and twisted his head toward Gabriel.
"I remember when you came here as a boy. It was 74 or 75, wasn't it?"
Tiepolo's eyes were on Gabriel, but his memory was fixed on Venice, 25 years earlier, a little workshop filled with eager young faces.
I remember when you served your apprenticeship with Umberto Conti. You were gifted, even then. You were better than everyone else. You were going to be great one day. Umberto knew it, so did I.
Tiepolo stroked his tangled beard with his big hand.
Did Umberto know the truth about you? Did he know you were an Israeli agent?
Umberto knew nothing.
You deceived Umberto Conti. You should be ashamed of yourself. He believed in Mario Del Vecchio.
Tiepolo paused, checked his anger, lowered his voice.
He believed Mario Del Vecchio would be one of the greatest restorers ever.
I always wanted to tell Umberto the truth, but I couldn't.
I have enemies, Francesco, men who destroyed my family, men who wish to kill me today for things that happened 30 years ago. If you think Italians have long memories, you should spend some time in the Middle East. We are the ones who invented the vendetta, not the Sicilians. Cain slew Abel, and east of Eden he was cast. And you were cast here, to our swampy island in the lagoon, to heal paintings.
It was a peace offering. Gabriel accepted it with a conciliatory smile.
Do you realize that in my profession I have just committed a mortal sin? I revealed myself to you, because I fear your friend is in grave danger.
Do you really think they intend to kill him?
They've killed many people already. They killed my friend.
Tiepolo looked around at the vacant campo.
I knew John Paul I as well, Albino Luciani. He was going to clean up the Vatican, sell off the church's assets, give the money to the poor people, revolutionize the church. He died after 33 days. A heart attack, the Vatican said.
Tiepolo shook his head.
There was nothing wrong with his heart. He had the heart of a lion, the courage of one, too. The changes he planned to bring to the church were going to make a lot of people angry. And so...
He shrugged his massive shoulders. Then he reached into his pocket, removed a mobile telephone, and quickly punched in a number from memory. He raised the phone to his ear and waited. When finally someone answered, he identified himself and asked for a man called Father Luigi Donati. Then he smothered the mouthpiece and whispered to Gabriel,
"The Pope's private secretary. He was with him here in Venice for years. Very discreet, fiercely loyal."
Evidently it was Donati who came on the line next, because for the next 5 minutes Tiepolo carried on an animated conversation, full of condescending remarks about Rome and the Curia. It was clear to Gabriel that Tiepolo had picked up a good deal of church politics from his friend the Pope. When finally he brought the conversation around to the point, he did it with such subtlety and grace that to Gabriel it seemed both innocent and urgent at the same time. The artistic intrigue of Venice had taught Tiepolo many valuable lessons. He was a man capable of holding two conversations at the same time. Finally, he killed the connection and slipped the telephone back into his pocket.
"Well," said Gabriel, "Father Donati is going to see the Pope."
Father Luigi Donati stared at the telephone for a long moment before deciding on his course of action, Tiepolo's words ringing in his ears.
"I need to see the Holy Father. It is important I see the Holy Father before Friday."
Tiepolo never spoke like that. His relationship with the Holy Father was strictly collegial, pasta and red wine and humorous stories that reminded the Pope of the good times in Venice before he had been made a prisoner of the Apostolic Palace. And why before Friday? What did Friday have to do with anything? Friday was the day the Holy Father would visit the synagogue. Was Tiepolo trying to tell him that there was a problem? Donati stood abruptly and set out for the papal apartments. He brushed past a pair of the Pope's household nuns without so much as a word, and entered the dining room. The Holy Father was entertaining a delegation of bishops from the American Midwest, and the conversation had come round to a topic His Holiness found revolting. He seemed relieved to see Donati stride into the room, even though Donati's demeanor was grim and businesslike. The priest stood next to his master and bent slightly at the waist, so that he could speak directly into his ear. The bishops took their cue from Donati's tense appearance and looked away. When Donati finished, the Pope laid down his knife and fork and closed his eyes for a moment. Then he looked up, nodded once, and returned his attention to his guests. "Now, where were we?" the Pope said as Donati strode from the room. They paced the length of the campo a half dozen times, waiting for the phone to ring. Tiepolo filled the empty, anxious minutes by peppering Gabriel with 100 questions about his work for Israeli intelligence, about his life and family, about what it was like for a Jew to be surrounded day and night by the images of Christianity. Gabriel answered those he could and gently fended off those that strayed into uncomfortable waters. Still skeptical that Gabriel was indeed not an Italian, Tiepolo goaded him into speaking a few words of Hebrew. For the next several minutes he and Chiara carried on a lively conversation, mostly at Tiepolo's expense, until they were interrupted by the chirp of the Italian cellular phone. He brought it to his ear, listened in silence for a moment, then murmured, "I understand, Father Donati." He severed the connection and slipped the phone back into his pocket. "Did he give you an answer?" asked Gabriel. Tiepolo smiled. Chapter 29. Rome. In the north of Rome, near a lazy bend in the Tiber, lies a tidy little piazza where tourists rarely venture. There is an ancient church with a cracked belfry and a bus stop that few people use. There is a coffee bar and a small bakery that prepares bread on the premises, so that in the early morning the smell of flour and yeast mingles with the marshy scent of the river. Directly opposite the bakery is a teetering tenement block with a pair of potted orange trees marking the entrance. On the top floor there is a large flat from where it is possible to see the dome of St. Peter's Basilica in the distance. The flat is rented by a man who rarely uses it. He does so as a favor to his masters in Tel Aviv. The building contained no lift, and to reach the flat it was necessary to navigate 4 gloomy flights of stairs. Chiara went first, followed by Gabriel and Francesco Tiepolo. Before she could slip her key into the lock, the door flew open and Shimon Pasner's square physique filled the frame. The memory of Gabriel and Chiara's flight from the beach was visible in the expression on his face. Had Ari Shamron and Eli Lavon not been standing 6 feet behind him, each puffing away on a Turkish cigarette, Gabriel was quite certain Pasner would have pounced. Instead, he was forced to silently hold his ground as Gabriel brushed past without a word and greeted Shamron. There would be no family quarrels tonight, not in front of an outsider. But one day, when Shamron was gone, Pasner would take his revenge. That's the way things always went in the office. Gabriel handled the introduction. "This is Francesco Tiepolo. Francesco, these are the guys. I won't insult you by giving them names, because they wouldn't be real in any case." Tiepolo seemed to take this news in good humor. Shamron stepped forward and took over the proceedings. He shook Tiepolo's hand and looked up directly into his eyes for a long moment. Tiepolo could see he was being appraised for trustworthiness, but made no sign that he found Shamron's undisguised scrutiny at all uncomfortable.
"I can't thank you enough for agreeing to help us, Signor Tiepolo. The Holy Father is a dear friend of mine. If any harm ever came to him, I would never be able to forgive myself, especially if I had been in a position to somehow prevent it. You may rest assured that our interests in this matter are in complete harmony."
Shamron finally released Tiepolo's hand and looked at Shimon Pasner.
"Bring him some coffee. Can't you see he's had a long journey?"
Pasner shot Gabriel an icy look and stalked off to the kitchen. Shamron ushered Tiepolo into the sitting room. The Venetian settled himself at the end of the couch. The rest gathered around him. Shamron wasted no more time on small talk.
"What time do you enter the Vatican?"
"I'm expected at the bronze doors at 6 o'clock this evening. Customarily, Father Donati greets me there and escorts me up to the third floor, to the papal apartments."
"Are you certain this man Donati is to be trusted?"
"I have known Father Donati as long as I have known the Holy Father. He is intensely loyal."
Shimon Pazna entered the room and handed Tiepolo a cup of espresso.
"It is important that the Pope and his aides feel comfortable,"
Shamron resumed.
"We will meet with His Holiness under any circumstances of his choosing. Obviously, we would prefer a secure location, some place where our presence will not be noted by certain elements of the Curia. Do you understand what I'm trying to say to you, Signor Tiepolo?"
Tiepolo raised the coffee to his lips and nodded vigorously.
"The information we wish to pass to the Holy Father is of a sensitive nature. If necessary, we will meet with a trusted aide, but we believe it would be best for the Pope to hear it with his own ears."
Tiepolo swallowed the espresso in a gulp and set the cup gently on the saucer.
"It would be helpful to me if I had some idea of the nature of this information."
Shamron allowed his face to register discomfort. Then he leaned forward.
It concerns the actions of the Vatican during the Second World War and a meeting that took place in a convent on Lake Garda a long time ago. You'll forgive me, Signor Tiepolo, if I say no more. And the nature of the threat to his life. We believe the threat to the Holy Father originates from forces inside the Church, which is why he needs to take additional steps to protect himself and those around him.
Tiepolo inflated his cheeks and expelled the air slowly.
You have one thing working to your advantage. Father Donati has told me on any number of occasions that he is concerned about the security around the Holy Father, so this will come as no surprise to him. As for the war,
Tiepolo hesitated, clearly choosing his words carefully,
let me just say that it is a topic to which the Holy Father has given a great deal of thought. He calls it a stain on the Church, a stain that he is determined to remove.
Shamron smiled.
Obviously, Signor Tiepolo, we are here to help.
At 5:45 p.m., a black Fiat sedan pulled up outside the entrance of the apartment house. Francesco Tiepolo settled himself in the back seat. Shamron and Shimon Pazna appeared briefly on the terrace and watched the car set out along the river toward the dome in the distance. 15 minutes later, the Fiat deposited the Venetian at the entrance of St. Peter's Square. Tiepolo slipped through the metal guard barrier and made his way along Bernini's colonnade as the bells of the basilica tolled 6 o'clock. At the bronze doors, he presented his name and Italian identity card to the Swiss guard. The guard consulted a clipboard, then compared Tiepolo's face to the photograph on the identity card. Satisfied, he allowed Tiepolo to enter the Apostolic Palace. Father Donati was waiting at the foot of the Scala Regia. As usual, he wore a grim expression, like a man perpetually bracing himself for bad news. He shook Tiepolo's hand coldly and led him upstairs to the papal apartments. As always, Tiepolo was taken aback by the appearance of the papal study. It was a simple room, much too austere for so powerful a man, he thought, yet completely in keeping with the humble clergyman he had come to know and admire in Venice. Pope Paul VII was standing in the window overlooking St. Peter's Square, a white figure posed against the crimson drapery. He turned as Tiepolo and Father Donati entered the room and managed a fatigued smile. Tiepolo fell to his knees, kissing the fisherman's ring. Then the Pope took Tiepolo by the shoulders and guided him to his feet. He seized the Venetian by his biceps and squeezed, seemingly drawing strength from the bigger man.
"You look well, Francesco. Obviously life in Venice continues to treat you well." "Until yesterday, Holiness, when I learned about a threat to your life."
Father Donati sat down, carefully crossed one leg over the other, and smoothed the crease of his trousers, a busy chief executive, eager to move the proceedings along.
"All right, Francesco," Donati said, "enough of the dramatics. Have a seat and tell me exactly what in God's name is going on."
Pope Paul VII was scheduled to dine that evening with a delegation of visiting bishops from Argentina. Father Donati telephoned the leader of the delegation, a prelate from Buenos Aires, and told him that unfortunately His Holiness was under the weather
and would not be able to host the meal. The bishop promised to pray for the Holy Father's speedy recovery. At 9:30, Father Donati stepped into the corridor outside the papal study and confronted the Swiss guard, standing watch. "The Holy Father wishes to walk in the gardens to meditate," Donati said briskly. "He'll be leaving in just a few moments." "I thought His Holiness was ill this evening," the Swiss guard replied innocently. "How His Holiness is feeling is none of your concern." "Yes, Father Donati, I'll notify the guards in the garden that His Holiness is coming."
"You will do no such thing. The Holy Father would like to meditate in peace."
The Swiss guard stiffened. "Yes, Father Donati." The priest walked back to the study, where he found Tiepolo helping the Pope into a long fawn overcoat and brimmed hat. With the coat buttoned, only the fringe of his white soutane was visible. There are 1,000 rooms in the Vatican, and countless miles of corridors and staircases. Father Donati had made it his business to learn every inch of them. He led the Pope past the Swiss guard, then spent the next 10 minutes winding his way downward through the labyrinthine passageways of the ancient palace. Here a murky shoulder-width tunnel with a dripping arched ceiling, here a flight of stone steps rounded by time, slick as ice. Finally, they came to a darkened underground garage. A small Fiat sedan was waiting. The Vatican SCV license plates had been replaced by normal Italian tags. Francesco Tiepolo helped the Pope into the back seat and joined him there. Father Donati climbed behind the wheel and started the engine. The Pope could not hide his alarm at this development.
"When was the last time you drove a car, Luigi?"
"To be honest, Holiness, I can't recall. It was certainly before we came to Venice."
"That was 18 years ago.
May the Holy Spirit protect us on our journey."
"And all the angels and saints," added the Pope.
Donati forced the car into gear and guided it timidly up a winding darkened ramp. A moment later the car emerged into the night. The priest hesitantly pushed the accelerator toward the floor and sped along the Via Belvedere toward St. Anne's Gate.
"Duck down, Holiness."
"Is that really necessary, Luigi?"
"Francesco, please help His Holiness conceal himself."
"I'm sorry, Holiness."
The big Venetian grabbed the Pope by the lapels of his overcoat and pulled him down into his lap. The Fiat sped past the Pontifical Pharmacy and the Vatican Bank. As they approached St. Anne's Gate, Father Donati switched on his headlights and sounded his horn. A stunned Swiss guard leapt out of the path of the speeding car. Father Donati made the sign of the cross as the car flashed through the gate and entered Rome proper. The Pope looked up at Tiepolo.
"May I sit up now, Francesco? This is most undignified."
"Father Donati?"
"Yes, I think it's safe now."
Tiepolo helped the Pope sit up and straightened his overcoat. It was Chiara, standing on the terrace of the safe flat, who spotted the Fiat entering the piazza. The car stopped in front of the building, and 3 men climbed out. Chiara ducked into the sitting room.
"There's someone here," she said. "Tiepolo and 2 other men. I think one of them might be him."
A moment later there was a sharp knock. Gabriel quickly crossed the room and pulled open the door. He was greeted by the sight of Francesco Tiepolo and a priest in clerical suit, flanking a small man in a long overcoat and a fedora hat. Gabriel stepped aside. Tiepolo and the priest ushered the man into the safe flat. Gabriel closed the door. As he turned around, he saw the little man remove his fedora and hand it to the priest. Perched on his head was a white zucchetto. Next, he removed the fawn overcoat, revealing a soutane of brilliant white. His Holiness, Pope Paul VII, said,
"I'm told that you gentlemen have some important information you'd like to impart to me. I'm all ears."
Chapter 30. Rome. The door of the flat opened to Longa's touch, just as the Italian had said it would. He closed it again and pushed the deadbolt into place before switching on the lights. He was greeted by the sight of a single room with a bare floor and watermarked walls. There was a steel bed, more like a cot than a real bed, with a wafer-thin mattress. No pillow, a scratchy woolen blanket folded at the foot. Stains. Piss? Semen? Lange could only guess. It was not unlike the room in Tripoli, where he had once spent a feverish fortnight, waiting for his guide from the Libyan Secret Service to take him to the training camps in the south. There were distinct differences about this place, though, namely the large carved wood crucifix hanging above the bed, adorned with a rosary and a length of dried palm leaf. Next to the bed was a small chest. Lange wearily pulled open the drawers. He found underpants, bald black socks, and a dog-eared breviary. With some trepidation, he ventured into the bathroom. A rust-stained basin with twin taps, a mirror that barely cast a reflection, a toilet with no seat. He opened the closet. Two clerical suits hung from the rod. On the floor was a pair of black shoes, well-worn but polished, the shoes of a poor man who took care of his appearance. Lange pushed the shoes out of the way with the toe of his loafer, and saw the loose floorboard. He bent down and pried it up. Reaching into the small space, he found a bundle of oilcloth. He unfolded the cloth. A Stetschkin pistol, a silencer, two magazines of 9mm ammunition. Lange rammed one magazine into the butt and slipped the Stetschkin into the waistband of his trousers. The silencer and the second magazine he rewrapped in the oilcloth. He reached into the compartment a second time and found two more items, a set of keys to the motorcycle parked outside the apartment house, and a leather billfold. He opened the billfold. Inside was a Vatican Security Office identification badge, quite obviously the real thing. Lange looked at the name. Manfred Beck, Special Investigations Division, then at the photograph. It was the one he had given Casagrande in the hotel room in Zurich. It was not him, of course, but the vague resemblance could easily be enhanced with a bit of preparation. Manfred Beck, Special Investigations Division. He returned the billfold to the compartment, then replaced the floorboard and covered it with the shoes. He looked around at the barren, lonely room. A priest's room, this. A sudden memory overtook him. A winding cobblestone street in Fribourg, a young man in a black cassock, drifting through the mist rising from the River Sarne. A young man in crisis, Lange remembered, a tormented man, a man who could not bear the acute loneliness of the life that lay ahead of him, a man who wanted to be on the front lines. How odd that the path he had chosen had resulted in a life more lonely than a parish priest's. How odd that it had led him back here to this desperate room in Rome. He went to the window and pushed open the glass. The wet night air washed over his face. The Stazione Termini stood in the distance, about a half kilometer away. Directly across the street lay a straggly, unkempt park. A woman was making her way along the puddled walkway. A street lamp briefly caught the Breton red highlights in her hair. Something made her look up at the open window. Training. Instinct. Fear. Seeing his face, she smiled and started across the road. Chapter 31. Rome. Ari Shamron had decided that there would be no misleading the Vicar of Christ. Gabriel was to tell him everything, with no regard for protecting sources or methods. He also ordered Gabriel to give the account chronologically, for Shamron, a man who had briefed a half dozen prime ministers, knew the value of a good story. He believed that the dirty details of how intelligence was acquired often made the conclusions more credible to the target audience, in this case the supreme pontiff of the Roman Catholic Church. They settled themselves in the sitting room. The Pope sat in a comfortable armchair, knees together, hands folded. Father Donati sat next to him, a notebook open on his lap. Gabriel, Shamron, and Eli Lavon squeezed shoulder to shoulder on the couch, separated from the Pope and his secretary by a low coffee table and a pot of tea that no one touched. Chiara and Shimon Pazna stood watch on the balcony. Francesco Tiepolo, his work complete, kissed the papal ring and left for Venice in the back of an office car. Gabriel spoke to the Pope in his native tongue, while Father Donati took furious notes. Every few minutes Donati would interrupt Gabriel by raising his silver pen and peering at him over his half-moon spectacles. Then he would force Gabriel to backtrack in order to clarify some seemingly mundane detail, or quibble with Gabriel on a point of translation. If it conflicted with what was written in his notebook, he would make a vast show of expunging the offending passage. When Gabriel recounted his conversation with Peter Malone, and the words crux vera were mentioned for the first time, Donati shot a conspiratorial glance at the Pope, which the pontiff pointedly ignored. For his part, the Pope remained silent. Sometimes his gaze was focused on his intertwined fingers. Sometimes his eyes would close as though he were at prayer. Only the deaths seemed to stir him from his reverie. With each killing, Benjamin Stern, Peter Malone, Alessio Rossi, and the four Carabinieri in Rome, the Crux Vera operative in the south of France, the Pope made the sign of the cross and murmured a few words of prayer. He never once looked at Gabriel or even at Father Donati. Only Shamron could capture his attention. The Pope seemed to find kinship with the old man. Perhaps it was the closeness of their age, or perhaps the Pope saw something reassuring in the fissures and ravines of Shamron's rugged face. But every few minutes, Gabriel would notice them staring at each other over the coffee table, as though it were a chasm of time and history. Gabriel handed Sister Regina's letter to Father Donati, who then read it aloud. The Pope wore an expression of grief on his face, his eyes tightly closed. To Gabriel it seemed like a remembered pain, the pain of an old wound being torn open. Only once did he open his eyes at the point Sister Regina wrote of the boy, sleeping on her lap. He looked across the divide at Shamron, holding his gaze for a moment, before closing his eyes once more and returning to his private agony. Father Donati handed the letter back to Gabriel when he was finished. Gabriel told the Pope of his decision to return to Munich to search Benjamin's apartment a second time, and of the document Benjamin had entrusted to the old caretaker, Frau Ratzinger.
"It's in German," Gabriel said. "Would you like me to translate it, Your Holiness?"
Father Donati answered the question for the Pope.
"The Holy Father and I both speak German fluently. Please feel free to read the document in its original language."
The memorandum from Martin Luther to Adolf Eichmann seemed to cause the Pope physical pain. At the halfway point, he reached out and took Father Donati's hand for support. When Gabriel finished, the Pope bowed his head and joined his hands beneath his pectoral cross. When he opened his eyes again, he looked directly at Shamron, who was holding Sister Regina's account of the meeting at the convent.
"A remarkable document, is it not, Your Holiness?"
Shamron asked in German.
"I'm afraid I would use a different word," the Pope said, answering him in the same language. "Shameful is the first word that comes to mind."
"But is it an accurate account of the meeting that took place at that convent in 1943?
Gabriel looked first at Shamron, then at the Pope. Father Donati opened his mouth to object, but the Pope silenced him by gently placing a hand on his secretary's forearm.
"It's accurate, except for one detail," said Pope Paul VII. "I wasn't really sleeping on Sister Regina's lap. I'm afraid I just couldn't bear to say another decade of the rosary."
And then he told them the story of a boy from a poor village in the mountains of northern Italy, a boy who found himself orphaned at the age of 9 with no relatives to turn to for support, a boy who made his way to a convent on the shores of a lake, where he worked in the kitchen and befriended a woman named Sister Regina Carcassi. The nun became his mother and his teacher. She taught him to read and write. She taught him to appreciate art and music. She taught him to love God and to speak German. She called him Cicciotto, little chubby one. After the war, when Sister Regina renounced her vows and left the convent, the boy left too. Like Regina Carcassi, his faith in the church was shaken by the events of the war, and he found his way to Milan, where he scratched out an existence on the streets, picking pockets and stealing from shops. Many times he was arrested and beaten up by police officers. One night, he was beaten nearly to death by a gang of criminals and left for dead on the steps of a parish church. He was discovered in the morning by a priest and taken to a hospital. The priest visited him each day and saw to the bills. He discovered that the filthy street urchin had spent time in a convent, that he could read and write, and knew a great deal about scripture and the church. He convinced the boy to enter the seminary and study for the priesthood as a way to escape a life of poverty and prison. The boy agreed, and his life was forever changed. Throughout the Pope's account, Gabriel, Shamron, and Eli Lavon sat motionless and enthralled. Father Donati looked down at his notebook, but his hands were still. When the Pope finished, a deep silence hung over the room, broken finally by Shamron.
"What you must understand, Your Holiness, is that it was not our intention to uncover the information about the Garda Covenant, or your past. We only wanted to know who killed Benjamin Stern, and why."
"I am not angry with you for bringing me this information, Mr. Shamron. As painful as these documents are, they must be made public, so that they can be examined by historians and ordinary Jews and Catholics alike, and placed in their proper context."
Shamron laid the documents in front of the Pope.
"We have no desire to make them public. We leave them in your hands, to do with them what you will."
The Pope tilted his head down at the papers, but his gaze was distant, his eyes lost in thought.
"He was not as wicked as his enemies have made him out to be, our Pope Pius XII. But, unfortunately, neither was he as virtuous as his defenders, the Church included, have claimed. He had his reasons for silence, fear of dividing German Catholics, fear of German retaliation against the Vatican, a desire to play a diplomatic role as a peacemaker. But we must face the painful fact that the Allies wanted him to speak out against the Holocaust, and Adolf Hitler wanted him to remain silent. For whatever reason, his hatred of communism, his love of Germany, the fact that he was surrounded by Germans in his papal household. Pius chose the course Hitler wanted, and the shadow of that choice hangs over us to this day. He wanted to be a statesman when what the world needed most was a priest, a man in a cassock, to shout at the murderers at the top of his lungs to stop what they were doing, in the name of God, and all that was decent."
The Pope looked up and studied the faces before him, first Lavon, then Gabriel, then finally Shamron, where his gaze lingered longest. "But we must face the uncomfortable fact that silence was a weapon in the hands of the Germans. It allowed the roundups and deportations to go forward with a minimum of resistance. There were hundreds, perhaps thousands, of Catholics who took part in rescuing Jews. But had the priests and nuns of Europe received instructions, or simply the blessing from their Pope to resist the Holocaust, many more Catholics would have sheltered Jews, and many more Jews would have survived the war as a result. Had the German episcopacy spoken up against the murder of Jews early on, it is possible that the Holocaust might never have reached its feverish pitch. Pope Pius knew that the wholesale mechanized murder of the European Jews was underway, but he chose to keep that information largely to himself. Why did he not tell the world? Why did he not even tell his bishops in the countries where roundups were taking place? Was he honoring a covenant of evil reached on the shores of a lake?" The Pope reached for the pot in the center of the table. When Father Donati leaned forward to help him, he raised his hand as if to say His Holiness still knew how to pour a cup of tea. He spent a moment reflectively stirring in the milk and sugar, before resuming. "I'm afraid the behavior of Pius is only one aspect of the war that needs examination. We must face the uncomfortable truth that, among Catholics, there were many more killers than there were rescuers. Catholic chaplains ministered to the very German forces committing the slaughter of the Jews. They heard their confessions and provided them the sacrament of Holy Communion. In Vichy, France, Catholic priests actually helped French and German forces round up Jews for deportation and death. In Lithuania, the hierarchy actually forbade priests to rescue Jews.
In Slovakia, a country ruled by a priest, the government actually paid the Germans to take away their Jews to the death camps. In Catholic Croatia, clergymen actually took part in the killings themselves. A Franciscan nicknamed Brother Satan ran a Croatian concentration camp where 20,000 Jews were murdered. The Pope paused to sip his tea, as though he needed to remove a bitter taste from his mouth. We must also face the truth that after the war, the Church sought leniency for the murderers and helped hundreds escape justice altogether. Shamron stirred restlessly in his seat, but said nothing. Tomorrow, at the great synagogue of Rome, the Catholic Church will begin to confront those questions honestly for the first time.
Your words are compelling, Your Holiness, said Shamron, but it might not be safe for you to venture across the river and say them aloud in a synagogue for the world to hear.
A synagogue is the only place for these words to be spoken, especially the synagogue in the Roman ghetto, where the Jews were rounded up, beneath the very windows of the Pope, without so much as a murmur of protest. My predecessor went there once to begin this journey. His heart was in the right place, but I'm afraid many segments of the Curia were not with him, and so his journey stopped short of its destination. I will finish it for him tomorrow, in the place where he started it.
It appears you have something else in common with your predecessor, Holiness, Shamron said. There are elements within the Church, quite probably here in Rome, who do not support the candid examination of the Vatican's role in the Holocaust. They have proven themselves willing to commit murder, to keep the past a secret, and you should act on the assumption that your life is now in danger as well.
You're referring to Crux Vera.
Does such an organization exist within the Church?
The Pope and Father Donati exchanged a long look. Then the Pope's gaze settled once more on Shamron.
I'm afraid Crux Vera does indeed exist, Mr. Shamron. The society was allowed to flourish during the 30s and throughout the Cold War because it proved to be an effective weapon in the fight against the Bolshevism. Unfortunately, many of the excesses committed in the name of that fight can be laid directly at the feet of Crux Vera and its allies.
And now that the Cold War is over? Asked Gabriel.
Crux Vera has adapted with the times. It has proved itself a useful tool for maintaining doctrinal discipline. In Latin America, Crux Vera has battled the adherents of liberation theology, sometimes resorting to ghastly violence to keep rebellious priests in line. It has waged a ceaseless fight against liberalism, relativism, and the tenets of the Second Vatican Council. As a result, many of those inside the Church who support the goals of Crux Vera have turned a blind eye to some of its more unseemly methods.
Is Crux Vera also engaged in an effort to keep unpleasant Church secrets from coming to light?
Without a doubt, answered Father Donati.
Is Carlo Casagrande a member of Crux Vera?
I suppose that in your line of work, he would be known as the Director of Operations.
Are there other members inside the Vatican itself? This time it was the Pope who answered Gabriel's question.
My Secretary of State, Cardinal Marco Brindisi, is the leader of Crux Vera,
the Pope said gloomily.
If you know Brindisi and Casagrande are members of Crux Vera, why do you allow them to keep their jobs?
Was it not Stalin who said, "Keep your allies close, but your enemies closer"?
A smile flashed over the Pope's face, then quickly evaporated.
Besides, Cardinal Brindisi is untouchable. If I tried to move against him, his allies in the Curia and the College of Cardinals would revolt, and the Church would be hopelessly divided. I'm afraid that for now I'm stuck with him and his henchmen.
Which brings us back to my original point, Holiness. Your security is being handled by men who oppose you and your mission. Under the circumstances, I think it would be wise for you to postpone your visit to the synagogue until a safer moment presents itself."
Then Shamron laid a file on the table and opened it. The dossier on the assassin, codenamed the Leopard, that he had taken from King Saul Boulevard.
"We believe this man is working for Crux Vera. He is, without a doubt, one of the world's most dangerous assassins. We are virtually certain he was the man who killed Peter Malone in London. We suspect he also killed Benjamin Stern. We must assume that he will now try to kill you."
The Pope looked at the photographs, then at Shamron.
"What you must remember, Mr. Shamron, is that I am under the protection of these men wherever I am, inside the Vatican walls or beyond them. The threat to me is the same, whether I am standing in the papal apartments or in the great synagogue of Rome."
"A point taken, Holiness."
Father Donati leaned forward. "Once the Holy Father steps beyond the walls of the Vatican onto Italian soil, his security is augmented by Italian police. Thanks to the false papal assassin plot engineered by Carlo Casagrande, security for tomorrow's event at the synagogue will be unprecedented. We believe that it is safe enough for His Holiness to make the appearance."
"And what if this man is a member of the Pope's security contingent?"
"The Holy Spirit will protect me during this journey," the Pope replied.
"With all due respect, Holiness, I would feel better if someone else was looking over your shoulder as well."
"You have a suggestion, Mr. Shamron?"
"I do, Holiness."
Shamron put a rough hand on Gabriel's shoulder.
"I'd like Gabriel to accompany you and Father Donati into the synagogue. He's an experienced officer who knows a thing or two about this sort of business."
The Pope looked at Father Donati.
"Luigi, surely this can be accomplished, can it not?"
"It can, Holiness, but there is one problem."
"You're referring to the fact that Carlo Casagrande has portrayed Mr. Allon as a papal assassin."
"I am, Holiness."
"Obviously, the situation will have to be handled carefully. But if there's one person the Swiss guards will listen to, it's me."
He looked at Shamron.
"I will make this pilgrimage to the ghetto as scheduled, and you will be at my side, protecting me, as we should have been at yours 60 years ago. Quite fitting, don't you think, Mr. Shamron?"
Shamron gave a curt nod and an iron smile.
"Indeed, it was."
20 minutes later, the arrangements for the morning complete, Father Donati and the Pope left the safe flat and sped along the river toward the Vatican. At St. Anne's Gate, the car braked to a halt. Father Donati lowered his window as a Swiss guard stepped out of his sentry post.
"Father Donati, what in the world is—"
The guardsman fell silent as Pope Paul VII leaned into view. Then the Swiss guard snapped to attention.
"Holiness!"
"No one must know about this," the Pope said evenly. "Do you understand me?"
"Of course, Holiness.
If you tell anyone, even your superiors, that you've seen me tonight, you will have to answer to me, and I promise you it won't be a pleasant experience."
"I won't say a word, Holiness, I swear."
"I hope so, young man, for your sake."
The Pope leaned back in his seat. Father Donati raised his window and sped toward the Apostolic Palace.
"I'm not sure that poor fellow is ever going to get over that," he said, suppressing laughter.
"Was that really necessary, Luigi?"
"I'm afraid so, Holiness."
"God forgive us," the Pope said. Then he added, "For everything we've done."
"It will all be over soon, Holiness."
"I pray you're right."
Chapter 32. Rome. Erich Langer did not sleep well that night. A rare bout of conscience? Nerves? Perhaps it was the furnace-like heat of Katrina's body nestled against him on the tiny cot. Whatever the reason, he awoke at 3:30 and lay there, wide-eyed, Katrina pressing against his ribs, until the first grey shreds of light entered the window of Carlo Casagrande's hateful room. He swung his legs out of the bed and crept naked across the bare floor to the window, parted the net curtains, and peered down into the street. His motorcycle was there, parked outside the entrance of the tenement house. There were no signs of surveillance. He released the curtain, and it fell back into place. Katrina stirred, wrestled with the blanket, then rolled over and slept on. Lange brewed a pot of espresso on the electric ring and drank several cups before entering the bathroom. He spent the next hour there, carefully grooming and altering his appearance. He darkened his hair with dye, transformed his grey eyes to brown with a pair of contact lenses. Lastly, he added eyeglasses, black-rimmed and cheap-looking, the spectacles of a priest. When he finished, the face staring back at him in the fogged glass was that of a stranger. He compared it to the photograph on the badge Casagrande had prepared for him. Manfred Beck, Special Investigation Division, Vatican Security Office. Satisfied, he went back into the main room. Katrina was still sleeping. Lange padded across the floor, a towel around his waist, and opened the dresser drawer. He slipped on underwear and a pair of the threadbare socks, then went to the closet and opened the door. Black shirt and Roman collar, black trousers, black suit jacket. Finally, he stepped into the shoes and carefully knotted the laces. He walked back to the bathroom and stared at himself for a long time in the mirror, slowly transforming himself into the man in the black suit, an actor assuming the role, an assassin wrapped in a priest's garments, the man he might have been, concealing the man he was. He slipped the Stetchkin into the waistband of his trousers, and looked at himself one last time. Priest, revolutionary, killer. "Which one are you, old man?" He poured the last of the coffee into a cup and sat down at the edge of the bed. Katrina opened her eyes and recoiled, hands reflexively padding the bedding for a weapon. When Lange gently touched her leg, she froze, a hand over her breast, as she tried to gather herself.
"My God, Eric, I didn't recognize you."
"That's the point, my dear." Lange handed her the cup of coffee.
"Get dressed, Katrina. We haven't much time."
Chiara was brewing coffee in the kitchen of the safe flat when the telephone rang. She recognized the voice of Father Donati.
"I'll be there in a minute or two.
Send him down."
Chiara hung up as Gabriel came into the room. He was wearing a grey suit, white shirt and dark tie, all compliments of Shimon Pasner's Rome station. Chiara brushed a bit of lint from his sleeve.
"You look very handsome."
Then she added,
"A bit like an undertaker, but handsome."
"Let's hope not. Who was on the phone?"
"Father Donati. He's on his way."
Gabriel swallowed a cup of coffee and pulled on a tan raincoat. Then he kissed Chiara on the cheek and held her in his arms for a moment.
"You will be careful, won't you, Gabriel?"
A car horn sounded outside. When Gabriel tried to pull away, Chiara held him tightly for a moment, refusing to let him leave. When Father Donati honked the horn again, this time with more urgency, she released her hold on him. Gabriel kissed her one last time. He slipped his beretta into a shoulder holster and walked downstairs. A grey Fiat sedan with Vatican plates stood outside the entrance. Father Donati sat behind the wheel, dressed in a clerical suit and a black raincoat. Gabriel climbed into the passenger seat and closed the door. Donati turned toward the Tiber embankment. It was a grey morning, low, dark clouds, a gusty wind making white caps on the river. The priest was hunched over the wheel, eyes wide, foot heavy on the accelerator. Gabriel squeezed the armrest, thinking that it was a miracle the Pope had made it back to the Vatican alive last night.
"Drive much, Father Donati?"
"Last night was the first time in about 18 years.
"I wouldn't have guessed."
"You're a terrible liar, Mr. Alone. I thought people in your line of work were supposed to be good at deception."
"How's the Holy Father this morning?"
"He's quite well, actually. Despite the events of last night, he managed to get a few hours of sleep. He's looking forward to his journey across the river."
"I'll be happy when it's over and he's safely back in the papal apartments."
"That makes two of us."
As they sped along the Tiber, Father Donati briefed Gabriel on the security arrangements. The Pope would travel to the synagogue in his usual armor-plated Mercedes limousine, accompanied by Donati and Gabriel. Immediately surrounding the Pope would be a ring of plain-clothed Swiss guards. As always, Italian police and security forces would provide a second cordon of protection. The route from the Vatican to the old ghetto would be lined by Carabinieri traffic units, and closed to all other traffic. The square dome of the great synagogue rose before them, a towering structure of pale grey stone and aluminum, Persian and Babylonian in its architectural design. The extreme height of the structure, coupled with its unique façade, made it stand out from the surrounding ochre-coloured Baroque buildings. The effect was intentional. The community that built the synagogue 100 years earlier had wished to make it easily visible to the men on the other side of the Tiber, the men behind the ancient walls of the Vatican. 100 meters from the synagogue, they came to a police checkpoint. Father Donati lowered his window, flashed his Vatican identification, and exchanged a few words in Italian with an officer. A moment later, they pulled into the courtyard at the front of the synagogue and braked to a halt. Before Father Donati could shut down the engine, they were set upon by a carabiniere with an automatic weapon slung over his shoulder. Gabriel liked what he saw so far. They climbed out of the Fiat. Gabriel could not help but feel the shadow of history hanging over the place. Rome was the oldest diaspora settlement in Western Europe, and Jews had been living in its center for more than 2,000 years. They had come to this place long before the fisherman named Peter from the Galilee. They had seen the assassination of Caesar, witnessed the rise of Christianity and the fall of the Roman Empire. Vilified by popes as murderers of God, they had been ghettoized on the banks of the Tiber, humiliated and ritually degraded. And on a night in October 1943, 1,000 were rounded up and sent to the gas chambers and ovens of Auschwitz, while a pope on the other side of the river said nothing. In a few hours' time, Pope Paul VII, a witness to the sins of the men in the Vatican, would come here to atone for the past, if he lives long enough to accomplish his mission. Father Donati seemed to sense Gabriel's thoughts, for he placed a hand gently on his shoulder and pointed toward the river. The protesters will be kept behind barricades over there, next to the embankment.
Protesters?
We're not expecting anything terribly large, just the usual lot. Donati shrugged helplessly. The birth control crowd, women in the priesthood, gays and lesbians, that sort of thing. They climbed the steps of the synagogue and went inside. Father Donati seemed perfectly at ease. He sensed Gabriel was looking at him, and he smiled confidently in response.
When we were still in Venice, it was my job to build better relations between the Patriarch and the Jewish community there. I'm quite comfortable in a synagogue, Mr. Alon.
I can see that, Gabriel said. Tell me how the ceremony will unfold.
The papal procession would form at the entrance of the synagogue, Father Donati explained. The Pope would walk up the center aisle accompanied by the chief rabbi, and take a seat next to him, in a gilded chair on the bima. Father Donati and Gabriel would trail the Holy Father during the walk to the front of the synagogue, then take their position in a special VIP section, a few feet from the Pope. The chief rabbi would make a few introductory remarks, then the Holy Father would speak. In a break with usual protocol, an advance text of the Pope's remarks would not be released to the Vatican press corps. The speech was bound to provoke an immediate reaction among the reporters, but no one would be permitted to leave their seat until the Pope had completed his remarks and left the synagogue. Gabriel and the priest walked to the front of the synagogue, the spot where they would be standing during the Pope's remarks. A carabiniere, with a bomb-sniffing dog straining at its leash, was making steady progress up the left side of the hall. A second dog team was working the opposite side. A few meters from the bima, a handful of television cameramen was setting up their equipment on a raised platform under the watchful gaze of an armed security man.
What about the other entrances to the synagogue, Father Donati?
They've all been sealed. There's only one way in and out now, and that's the main entrance.
Donati looked at his watch.
I'm afraid we haven't much time, Mr. Alon. If you're satisfied, we should be getting back to the Vatican.
Let's go.
Father Donati waved his Vatican ID badge at the Swiss guard standing watch at St. Anne's gate. Before the guard could question the identity of the man in the passenger seat, the priest pushed his foot to the floor and sped along the Via Belvedere toward the Apostolic Palace. Father Donati left the car in the San Damaso courtyard, hustled Gabriel around the security checkpoints, and headed upstairs toward the papal apartments. Gabriel's feet felt light on the marble floor, his pulse quickened. He thought of Shamron, standing in the half-light of the Campo di Ghetto Nuovo, summoning him to find the men who had murdered Benjamin Stern. Now his search had brought him here, to the epicenter of the Roman Catholic Church. At the entrance to the papal apartments, they slipped past a Swiss guard and went inside. Father Donati led him into the study, where the Pope was seated at his desk, working through a stack of morning correspondence. He looked up at Gabriel as he entered the room and smiled warmly.
"Mr. Allon, so good of you to come."
With the tip of his pen, he pointed toward the seating area next to the fireplace. "Please make yourself comfortable. Father Donati and I have a few things to attend to before we leave." Gabriel did as the Pope instructed. He reached into the breast pocket of his jacket and removed the photographs of the assassin known as the Leopard. Gabriel started from the beginning and worked his way forward. In each picture, the assassin looked remarkably different. Some of the changes had been achieved through plastic surgery, others through more prosaic means, such as hats, wigs, and eyewear. Gabriel returned the photographs to his pocket and looked across the study toward the little man in white, hunched over a stack of papers at his desk. He felt his spirit sink. If the Leopard had come to Rome to kill the Pope, it would be almost impossible to stop him. And based on the photographs in his pocket, Gabriel was quite certain he would never see him coming. Langer sanitized the flat while Katrina showered and dressed. With a wet cloth, he meticulously wiped down every surface that he had touched in the room. Doorknobs, the dresser top, bathroom fixtures, the electric ring, the coffee pot. Then he placed his extra clothing in a plastic rubbish bag, along with his toiletries. Satisfied that he had erased every trace of himself from the flat, he sat on the edge of the bed, careful not to touch anything. Katrina came out of the bathroom. She wore blue jeans, lace-up leather boots, and a bomber-style jacket. Her hair was pulled back tightly against her scalp, her eyes covered by a pair of sunglasses. She looked very beautiful. The average carabinieri would find her terribly distracting. Langer was counting on that. He stood up, slipped the Stetchkin into his trousers, and buttoned his jacket. Then he pulled on a cheap black nylon raincoat, the kind worn by half the clerics in Rome, and picked up the bag of rubbish. They walked downstairs. Langer held the rubbish bag in one hand, and with the other he drew the collar of his raincoat tight to conceal the clerical suit underneath. Outside, he mounted the motorcycle and started the engine. Katrina climbed on the back and wrapped her arms around his waist. He eased forward, turned the bike east toward the ancient center of Rome, and opened the throttle. Along the way, he dropped the keys to the flat down a sewer. The bag of rubbish he handed to a garbage collector, who tossed it into the back of his truck, and wished Langer a pleasant morning.
This book is continued on Disc 9.